that he was untouched by a Titanism of this sort. "Let the dead bury their dead" is certainly a tidy summary of the yogi's typical view of the world. "Sell all that you have and follow me" is the first requirement placed by the guru on the candidate for release. But there is a quality, at least in the legend of Christ, that would seem to imply something considerably more gentle than sheer titanic disdain. And this brings us to the next transformation of the Titan principle in the sphere of the agricultural civilizations. In the period of the early Upanishads, the 8th and 7th centuries BC, it began to appear to some of the Indian Titans that what was being sought by their fellows in isolation is to be found everywhere, that the inward center of absolute repose which the forest yogis were attaining by a removal of themselves from the world actually inhabits the world as the ground of its reality. The silence is to be heard resounding even through and within the tones of Aum. A shift of perspective, therefore, is what is required, and this is not achieved by running away. Running away implies the recognition of two distinct states, that of bondage and that of release. What the yogi must realize, however, is that all distinctions whatsoever, even this one, which is a great favorite of yogis, belong to that sphere of rational logic wherein A is not not A. The world, the gods, man, and all things have only to be looked upon with a new eye, but looked upon, not shunned. Though it is hidden in all things, that self shines not forth. Yet it is seen by subtle seers, with superior subtle intellect. As the one fire has entered the world and become corresponding in form to every form, so the one interior self of all things corresponds in form to every form and yet is beyond. The inward self of all things, the one controller who makes his one form manifold, the wise who perceive him as standing within themselves, they and no others know eternal bliss. The titanic aspect of this kind of knowledge becomes apparent the moment it is realized that since everything is to be experienced as an epiphany of the one holy power, there can be no such fundamental distinction between good and evil, holiness and vice, God and the devil, as the lords and guardians of the mandala would have us believe. In fact, and this in time was to become one of the principles of the so-called left-hand path, to give credence to such a belief is to remain locked in the fractional state characteristic of those caught in the great trap of reason, virtue, and the law. Those tantric disciplines of illumination where the five forbidden things become the five good things, rungs on the ladder of illumination as well as the wild images of erotic orgy that abound on many of the temples of the Indian Middle Ages, let us know that when all is divine, all is affirmed. And with a degree of emphasis that is no less appalling to the socially grounded, readily shocked, anti-mystical consciousness than the ruthless world denial of the earlier dismissers of the body. And so again we have a discipline of disengagement, now, however, not observed through a dismissal of the signs and symbols that, for others, imply engagement, but through a dismissal merely of their references. Throughout the period of one's life, throughout the period of one's residence in the sphere of time, one is to go on being continually released from the bowstring. Bhoga is yoga, became the great cry. Delight is religion. Or again, it is here, it is here. And whereas for the forest philosopher every thrill of the senses was a danger, a distraction of the mind from that point of concentration through which the unmoving state was to be attained, and the first exercise of all discipline was to be dhamma, control, the restraint of the external organs, now, on the contrary, the identity of temporal experience and eternal realization, samsara and nirvana, has become the first principle both of philosophy and of practice. Whether in the floods of passion or in the desert of boredom, the honey doctrine of the universal presence is to be tested for its truth, and its truth experienced in act. In the ocean of Brahman we read, "Filled with the nectar of absolute bliss, what is to be shunned and what accepted? What is there that is not myself, and what is there that is different in kind?" In the West, this brand of Titanism may have had its day in some of the early Gnostic cults, which apparently shocked the conventional Romans enough to give Christianity a very bad name. Split the stick, runs a Gnostic aphorism, and there is Jesus. But the memories of such beliefs have been pretty well expunged from the Western record. In the period of the Renaissance, however, there was a fresh stir of such possibilities. The sense of the imminent presence of God in all things, which inspired much of the new life, as well as the art that burgeoned in that period, conduced to a hardiness in experiment that tended to break the bounds not only of the astronomical and geographical orders, but of the moral as well. Sin bravely, said Luther, fortiter pecca. And he was not the only man of his age to have recognized the spiritual sense of such a command. But we are still in a trap, for we are attached to something. We are attached to the idea of enlightenment, release from the bow, disengagement. According to these disciplines, full of striving, tumult, and ecstasy, it would still appear that there is a notable difference between the subtle seers with subtle intellect who know, and those of us who are not so wise. The ultimate import of the principle of non-duality, the identity of A and not A, that is to say, has still to be given its full due. And so we are brought to a fourth and final stage in the development of the Titan principle within the circle of the social mandala. What is now to be realized simply carries one step further the principle just described as that of stage three. For if bhoga is yoga, if samsara is nirvana, then illusion is enlightenment, engagement disengagement, and bondage is freedom. There is nothing to be done, no effort to be made, for in our very bondage we are free, and in our very striving for release we are linking ourselves the more to bondage, which is already freedom. We are here presented with what a modern physicist would call, I believe, a pair of aspects system, or a principle of complementarity. According to the one mode or aspect of our experience, all things, ourselves included, are implicated in a context of space-time determinants and are bound, and yet simultaneously, according to the other mode of our experience, which is impossible to reconcile with the first, all things, ourselves included, are freely creating themselves all the time, spontaneously arising. Professor Max Noll discussed this double-aspect predicament in his Uranus lecture of 1951 when he contrasted the dynamic and the structural, the energetic and the space-time modes of description in physics and psychology. In the Buddhism known as the Mahayana, the Great Vehicle, this same realization is rendered in the concept and ideal of the Bodhisattva, the Great Savior, the reality of whose being, Sattva, is enlightenment, Bodhi, and who yet has not vanished in nirvana, but has remained in the world, which is already nirvana, out of love and compassion for the forms of the world. The great point of this profoundly paradoxical doctrine or ideal is that we are all that bodhisattva, simultaneously bound and free, implicated in a context of space-time determinants, yet spontaneously arising. Indeed, that all things are that bodhisattva. Let me term this stage in the development of the Titan principle, therefore, that of the realization of universal saviorhood. Consider the lilies of the fields, how they grow. They toil not, neither do they spin. The meaning of release, disengagement, freedom, moksha, is no longer escape. The term has become a reference, rather, to a mode or aspect of our present being and sense of being. Bodhisattvahood is precisely and merely that non-duality which is everywhere experienced through a pair of aspects and, though generally thought and said to be dual, is actually and immediately known to be not so. Let us for a moment contrast this ideal with that of Prometheus, defying Zeus, who suggests an irreconcilable dichotomy between the principle of the free individual and that of the social and cosmological order. The realization of the Bodhisattva recognizes that any such sense of a radical dichotomy is an effect simply of systematic thinking. In accord with the principle of complementarity, we should say rather, Prometheus and Zeus, I and the Father, are one. But how can we attain to this realization, which is already ours, somewhere in our being? There is a legend that tells of the Buddha teaching, speaking to the minds of those with ears to hear, and as he taught, his hand lifted a lotus. The only one with eyes to see was the sage Kashyapa, who, being ripe for illumination, saw the lotus. In the way of a religious or doctrinal reference, the lotus lifted by the Buddha might have been interpreted allegorically as signifying the lotus of the world, which is our vehicle of redemption. For, as we are taught by the well-known Buddhist prayer and aspiration, the jewel in the lotus, Om Mani Padme Hum, the jewel of nirvana is in the lotus of life. Which is to say that, since according to the testimony of those illuminated ones who have transcended the dualistic deceptions of the senses and logical thought, bondage and freedom are the same, this world itself, with all its pains and imperfections, is to be known as the golden lotus world of perfect purity and joy. It could certainly have been supposed that the lotus lifted in the Buddha's hand might have been a reference to some such idea, and the reference then would have constituted the meaning of the symbol. But then, of course, we, as good modern logicians, ambitious for the precision of science, would have had to ask whether this proposition could be demonstrated either by direct or by indirect verification. And failing verification, we should have had either to reject it as representing a disproved hypothesis, or to consign it to the category of mere expression, like a poem, a cry, or a piece of music, as a pretty symptom of the Buddha's feeling about the world, his mood or character, his sense of affinity with the world of nature, his personal charm or whatnot. However, with all these referential considerations, logical propositions, psychological intuitions, and fine notions about our own exactitude, we should not yet even have begun to try to see or imagine what it was that Kashyapa saw when he saw just that lotus. Aldous Huxley, in his little book, The Doors of Perception, describes the impressions he received during the course of a day when he had swallowed 0.4 grams of mescaline dissolved in 1/2 glass of water. He tells of a chair that he saw in a garden. For what seemed an immensely long time, I gazed without knowing, even without wishing to know, what it was that confronted me. At any other time, I would have seen a chair barred with alternate light and shade. Today, the percept had swallowed up the concept. I was so completely absorbed in looking, so thunderstruck by what I actually saw, that I could not be aware of anything else. Where the shadows fell on the canvas upholstery, stripes of a deep but glowing indigo alternated with stripes of an incandescence so intensely bright that it was hard to believe that they could be made of anything but blue fire. Garden furniture, lathes, sunlight, shadow, these were no more than names and notions, mere verbalizations for utilitarian purposes after the event. The event was this succession of azure furnace doors separated by gulfs of unfathomable gentian. It was inexpressibly wonderful, wonderful to the point almost of being terrifying. And suddenly I had an inkling of what it must feel like to be mad. Thus it was, I imagine, that Kashyapa saw the lotus in the Buddha's hand, though without such emotional affect. It was not a reference to any teaching associated with a figure of the lotus or an expression of the character, mood, sentiments, or emotions of the Buddha. Neither was it a reference to the botanical genus of the lotus. It was simply that lotus, that thing which it was and no other thing, a mysterium tremendum, as we all are. But we are all protected from each other by our references, the engrams of those cosmic systems to which we have been educated and to which our minds immediately refer the data of the senses. Following these references, we let the concept swallow up the percept, and so reverse the process of a revelation, thus defending ourselves from experience. And yet each thing, each person, all around us all the time, each insisting on itself as being that thing which it is and no other thing, is striving with all its might to provide an experience of itself. Some minds require mescaline to dissolve in them their references. Others may be quelled by the hypnotizing beat of a drum or the rhythmical organization of a work of art. For example, which of us ever looked, really, at an old pair of shoes until they were shown to us by Van Gogh? Certain religious exercises involving the repetition of meaningless or almost meaningless syllables, the contemplation of some design or image, or the prolonged consideration of metaphysical riddles until the mind breaks, may be meant to effect a similar result. To lull, hypnotize, or dissolve the busy brain and release the senses. The phenomena of dream commonly impress us more strongly than those of waking life, just because in sleep the brain is off guard. If it could be caught off guard when we were awake, this directly obvious pratyaksha world, deprived of its varnish of meaning, would shine forth of itself. Our experience then would be paramartha pratyaksha, in the highest manner before the eyes. Immediate, unmitigated, perfectly direct. This order of experience has been described for us by the Zen masters of China and Japan in terms that may seem a little strange and puzzling as the doctrine of no mind. However, I believe if expressed in terms more congenial to our own tradition, the experience would be recognized as one that we ourselves have had on occasion. In the simplest terms, I think we might say that when a situation or phenomenon evokes in us a sense of existence, instead of some reference to the possibility of an assurance of meaning, we have had an experience of this kind. The sense of existence evoked may be shallow or profound, more or less intense according to our capacity or readiness, but even a brief shock, say for example, when discovering the moon over city roofs or hearing a sharp bird cry at night, can yield an experience of the order of no mind, that is to say, the poetical order, the order of art. When this occurs, our own reality beyond meaning is awakened, or perhaps better, we are awakened to our own reality beyond meaning, and we experience an affect that is neither thought nor feeling, but an interior impact. The phenomenon, disengaged from cosmic references, has disengaged ourselves by that principle, well known to magic, by which like conjures like. In fact, both the magic of art and the art of magic derive from and are addressed to experiences of this order. Hence the power of the meaningless syllables, the mumbo-jumbo of magic, and the meaningless verbalizations of metaphysics, lyric poetry, and art interpretation. They function evocatively, not referentially, like the beat of a shaman's drum, not like a formula of Einstein. One moment later, and we have classified the experience and may be having utterable thoughts and describable feelings about it, thoughts and feelings that are in the public domain, and they will be either sentimental or profound according to our education, but according to our life, we have had, for an instant, a sense of existence, a moment of unevaluated, unimpeded, lyric life, antecedent to both thought and feeling, such as can never be communicated by means of empirically verifiable propositions, but only suggested by art. And now I think I am ready to formulate two or three final suggestions. The first is that since what we are now discussing is an experience not of the relatively unknown, but of the absolutely unknowable, it cannot be termed knowledge in the usual Occidental sense of the term. It is true that the Sanskrit terms bodhi, vidya, and prajna, which refer to this range of experience, are commonly translated with such words as knowledge, supreme knowledge, illumination, enlightenment, or wisdom, but the history of these words in our tradition makes it impossible for them to carry the meaning intended. According to the Oriental usage, everything to which these words of ours refer is to be known as avidya. Non-knowledge, the lack of enlightenment, ignorance, folly, delusion. Let us accept this suggestion and recognize then that what is intended by art, metaphysics, magical hocus-pocus, and mystical religion is not the knowledge of anything, not truth or goodness or beauty, but an evocation of a sense of the absolutely unknowable. Science, on the other hand, will take care of what can be known. Art and science, then, and here, in line with the suggestion already quoted from Professor Rudolf Carnap, I'm including under the term art the whole vocabulary of metaphysics and religion, Art and science constitute a pair of aspects system. The function of art is to render a sense of existence, not an assurance of some meaning, so that those who require an assurance of meaning or who feel unsure of themselves and unsettled when they learn that the system of meaning that would support them in their living has been shattered must surely be those who have not yet experienced profoundly, continuously, or convincingly enough that sense of existence, of spontaneous and willing arising, which is the first and deepest characteristic of being, and which it is the province of art to waken. What, I ask, is the meaning of a flower? And having no meaning, should the flower then not be? And so, with reference now to our problem of the symbol, we may say that a symbol, like everything else, shows a double aspect. We must distinguish, therefore, between the sense and the meaning of the symbol. It seems to me perfectly clear that all the great and little symbolical systems of the past functioned simultaneously on three levels: the corporeal of waking consciousness, the spiritual of dream, and the ineffable of the absolutely unknowable. The term meaning can refer only to the first two, but these today are in the charge of science, which is the province, as we have said, not of symbols, but of signs. The ineffable, the absolutely unknowable, can be only sensed, and not more in the religious sanctuary today than elsewhere. It is of the province of art, which is not expression merely, or even primarily, as Professor Carnap and the other logical positivists have supposed, but a quest for and formulation of experience-evoking, energy-waking images, yielding what Sir Herbert Reed has aptly termed a sensuous apprehension of being. I will not dwell on this point any longer. I think it must be clear by now that a certain relationship is indicated here between the courage of the Paleolithic hunter in his individualism and his willingness to face unprotected the spiritual experiences available to our race. Personally, though I do not wish to make a point of this, I believe that there is a precise relationship between the format or stature of the psyche and the quantum of immediate experience that one is capable of sustaining and absorbing, and that the training and shaping of the mandala-conditioned psyche of the incomplete man of the agriculturally based societies has simply unfitted him for the reception of the full impact of any mysterium whatsoever. Aldous Huxley has noted that what he saw when, for once, he really saw something was wonderful almost to the point of being terrifying, so that suddenly he had an inkling of what it must feel like to be mad. The mad are those who, when they have broken contact with the mode of meaning, with the integrating component of thinking consciousness, cannot again restore it. Whereas the great artist, like the shaman, like the Paramahamsa, the supreme wild gander of the titanic yogic flight, can be carried away and return. And so now my second suggestion is that today, when the mandala itself, the whole structure of meaning to which society and its guardians would attach us, is dissolving, what is required of us all, spiritually as well as corporeally, is much more the fearless self-sufficiency of our shamanistic inheritance than the timorous piety of the priest-guided Neolithic. Those of us who never dared to be titans, but only obedient children, following as loyally as possible the commands of Zeus or Yahweh or the state, now find that the commands themselves are in a somewhat fluent condition, changing with time. For the circle has been broken, the mandala of truth. The circle is open, and we are sailing on a sea more vast than that of Columbus. The propositions of science which have broken the mandala, and to which we are referred for our morality, knowledge, and wisdom, do not pretend to be true in any final sense, do not pretend to be infallible or even durable, but are merely working hypotheses, here today and gone tomorrow. There is no guiding bird, no landfall, no Hispaniola that is not soon dissolved in further revelations of outer and inner space. O ye, said Dante at that point on his journey when, taking leave of the earthly paradise on the summit of the cosmic mountain in the southern ocean, he was about to set forth for the sphere of the moon, O ye who in a little bark, desirous to listen, have followed behind my craft which, singing, passes on, Turn to see again your shore, put not out upon the deep, for haply losing me ye would remain astray. The water which I take was never crossed. Minerva breathes, and Apollo guides me, and the nine muses point out to me the bears. But Dante, through a series of theological propositions, reached in safety the term of his voyage, the Empyrean, the River of Light, and the Celestial Rose, beyond the sphere of the fixed stars. And there, as he declares, he found the ultimate image confirmed to the measure of the circle, and in this high vision his desire and his will were resolved, like a wheel which is moved evenly, by the love which moves the sun and the other stars. Our circle today, however, is rather that announced 2 centuries later by the genius of Nicholas Cusanus, whose circumference is nowhere and whose center is everywhere, the circle of infinite radius, which is also a straight line. Or, to state the principle in other terms, our meaning is now the meaning that is no meaning, for no fixed term of reference can be drawn, and to support such a temporal situation each must discover himself to be the Titan, without fear of the open world. As the researches and writings of Dr. Jung have shown us, the deep aim and problem of the maturing psyche today is to recover wholeness. But such a recovery will necessarily center us far deeper within ourselves and within the universe than any concept or image that we may hold of man or of humanitas can possibly suggest. As the Californian poet Robinson Jeffers has declared, "Humanity is the start of the race. I say humanity is the mold to break away from, the crust to break through, the coal to break into fire, the atom to be split." The first stage of the process of individuation, Jung has described as one of dissolving, not reinforcing, the individual's identification of his personality with the claims of the collective archetypes. These, I have tried to show, are functions not only of the psyche, but also of the history of society, and today are in full dissolution. The scientific method has released us intellectually from the absolutes of the mythological ages. The divine authority of the religiously founded state has been completely dissolved, at least in the Occident, and the power-driven machine is progressively releasing human energy from the onerous physical tasks that were formerly rationalized as valuable moral disciplines. Thus released, these energies constitute what Jung has termed a quantum of disposable libido, now flowing from the corporeal to the spiritual task. And this spiritual task can now be only that which I have here termed the task of art. The epoch of the Renaissance, to which we owe in large measure the scientific vision, was at its apogee in 1492, the year of the death of Lorenzo the Magnificent, as well as that of the fall of Granada and discovery of the New World. Leonardo da Vinci that year was 40 years old, Machiavelli 23, Copernicus 19. Moreover, by another coincidence, precisely in the year of the first battle of the American Revolution, James Watt conceived the idea of the steam condenser, to which we owe the first successfully operated power-driven machine. And so, in a sense, it is true indeed, or at least true enough, that the world in which we are now living was not only created in 1492, but redeemed in 1776. Within the time of our lives, it is highly improbable that any solid rock will be found to which Prometheus can again be durably shackled, or against which those who are not Titans will be able to lean with confidence. The creative researches and wonderful daring of our scientists today partake far more of the lion spirit of shamanism than of the piety of priest and peasant. They have shed all fear of the bounding serpent king, and if we are to match their courage, and thus participate joyfully in their world without meaning, we must allow our own spirits to become, like theirs, wild ganders, and fly in timeless, spaceless flight, like the body of the Virgin Mary, not into any fixed heaven beyond the firmament, for there is no heaven out there, but to that seat of experience simultaneously without and within, where Prometheus and Zeus, I and the Father, the meaninglessness of the sense of existence and the meaninglessness of the meanings of the world are one. The Secularization of the Sacred, first published in The Religious Situation, 1968, edited by Donald R. Cutler and published by Beacon Press. The Tree in the Garden. As I understand the phrase, the secularization of the sacred, it suggests an opening of the sense of religious awe to some sphere of secular experience, or, more marvelously, to the wonder of this whole world and oneself within it. One day, said, for example, the Indian saint and sage Sri Ramakrishna, it was suddenly revealed to me that everything is pure spirit. The utensils of worship, the altar, the door frame, all pure spirit. Men, animals, and other living beings, all pure spirit. Then, like a madman, I began to shower flowers in all directions. Whatever I saw, I worshipped. One day, while worshipping Shiva, I was about to offer a bell leaf on the head of the image when it was revealed to me that this Virat, this universe itself, is Shiva. Another day, I had been plucking flowers when it was revealed to me that each plant was a bouquet adorning the universal form of God. That was the end of my plucking flowers. I look on man in just the same way. When I see a man, I see that it is God himself who walks on earth, as it were, rocking to and fro like a pillow floating on the waves. Another time, when he was approaching an image of the goddess Kali to pay it worship, someone said to him, "I have heard it was made by the sculptor Nabin." "Yes, I know," he answered, "but to me, she is the embodiment of spirit." Actually, this order of experience is basic not only to Indian religiosity, but to the entire range of the high religions of the Orient eastward of Iran. We have it in the Buddhist aspiration, Om Mani Padme Hum, the jewel in the lotus, the jewel of absolute reality, nirvana, is in the lotus of the universe, in life. Likewise, in the Chinese concept of the Tao, the valley spirit never dies. It is the base from which heaven sprang, and earth. It is here within us all the while. The ultimate goal of Oriental worship is, accordingly, the realization of one's own identity with this reality, and a recognition of its presence in all things, not, as in our Western religions, to worship a God distinct from his creation, of a different order of being, apart, out there. A telling statement to this point appears in the ancient Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, circa 700 BC. This that people say, worship this God, worship that God, one God after another. This whole universe itself is his creation, and he himself is all the gods. Whoever worships one or another of those knows not. He is incomplete as worshipped in one or another. One should worship with the thought that he is one's own essential self, for therein all these become one. Whoever thus knows, "I am Brahman," becomes this all. Not even the gods have the power to prevent his becoming thus, for he then becomes their self. So whoever worships a divinity other than this self, thinking he is one and I another, knows not. He is like a sacrificial animal for the gods, and as many animals would be of service to a man, even so is each single person of service to the gods. But if even one animal is taken away, it is not pleasant. What then, if many? It is not pleasing to the gods, therefore, that people should know this. Compare with this the book of Genesis. Then the Lord God said, "Behold, the man has become like one of us, knowing good and evil. And now, lest he put forth his hand and take also of the tree of life and eat and live forever, therefore the Lord God sent him forth from the Garden of Eden to till the ground from which he was taken. He drove out the man, and at the east of the Garden of Eden he placed the cherubim and a flaming sword which turned every way to guard the way to the tree of life." But this way to the tree of life is exactly the marga, the path of the Indian disciplines, the Tao of the Chinese, the gateless gate, Mumon of Zen, and the cherubim at the entrance to the Garden of the Knowledge of Immortality, guarding it with a flaming sword, correspond exactly to the temple guardians at the entrance to any Oriental sanctuary. Never shall I forget a picture that I saw in a New York newspaper during our recent war with Japan. It showed one of the two giant temple guardians at the gate to the Todaiji Temple in Nara, fierce figures with lifted swords. There was no picture of the temple itself or of the Buddha within. Beneath the Tree of Enlightenment, hand lifted in the fear not gesture, but only that one threatening cherub in his frightening attitude, and beneath the picture the legend, "The Japanese worship gods like this." The only thought that crossed my mind, and it is with me still, was the obvious one. Not they, but we. For it is we whose God would keep men out of the garden. The Oriental idea, on the contrary, is to go past the guardian cherubim and to pluck the fruit of the tree of immortal life ourselves right now, while here on earth. Religions of Identity. Such an aim and such a realization I'm going to call mythic identification. Briefly, the underlying idea is that the ultimate truth, substance, support, energy, or reality of the universe transcends all definition, all imaging, all categories, and all thought. It is beyond the reach of the mind, that is, transcendent. Consequently, to ask as our theologians do, is the Godhead just, merciful, wrathful? Does it favor this people or that, the Jew, the Christian, or Mohammedan? Is from this point of view absurd. To think thus is to project human sentiments and concerns beyond their temporal sphere, and so to short-circuit the problem altogether. It is a kind of anthropomorphism, hardly more appropriate to a developed religion than the attribution of gender to the source mystery of being, which is another of the absurdities of our bewildering religions. But now, on the other hand, and here is the great point, that which is thus ultimately transcendent of all definition, categories, names, and forms is the very substance, energy, being, and support of all things, including ourselves, the reality of each and all of us. Transcendent of definition, transcendent of enclosure, it is yet immanent in each. Om Mani Padme Hum. Take, for example, a pencil, ashtray, anything, and, holding it before you in both hands, regard it for a while. Forgetting its use and name, yet continuing to regard it, ask yourself seriously, what is it? As James Joyce states in Ulysses, and here is the touchstone of his art, any object intensely regarded may be a gate of access to the incorruptible aeon of the gods. Cut off from use, relieved of nomenclature, its dimension of wonder opens, for the mystery of the being of that thing is identical with the mystery of the being of the universe, and of yourself. Schopenhauer, somewhere in his great work, The World as Will and Representation, has summarized the leading theme of his philosophy in a single memorable sentence. Everything is the entire world as will in its own way. And in the Indian Chandogya Upanishad, there is the famous phrase addressed by the charming sage Aruni to his son, Shvetaketu, Tat Tvam Asi. You are it. You, Shvetaketu, my son, are yourself, that immortal being of beings. The Oriental sages and their texts are unanimous in insisting, however, that the you referred to in teachings of this kind is not exactly the you that you think yourself to be, individuated in space and time, a temporary member of this world of passing forms, named, loved, and separate from your neighbor. Neti, neti, not this, not this, is the meditation properly applied to everything so known, so named, and so numbered. All those facets of the jewel of reality that present themselves to the mind. I am not my body, my feelings, my thoughts, but the consciousness of which these are the manifestations. For we are all, in every particle of our being, precipitations of consciousness, as are likewise the animals and plants, metals cleaving to a magnet and waters tiding to the moon. And as the great physicist Erwin Schrödinger states in his book, My View of the World, to divide or multiply consciousness is something meaningless. In all the world, there is no kind of framework within which we can find consciousness in the plural. This is simply something we construct because of the spatio-temporal plurality of individuals, but it is a false conception. What, he asks, justifies you in obstinately discovering this difference, the difference between you and someone else, when objectively what is there is the same? This life of yours which you are living is not merely a piece of the entire existence, but is, in a certain sense, the whole. Only this whole is not so constituted that it can be surveyed in one single glance. And this, as we know, is what the Brahmins expressed in that sacred mystic formula which is really so simple and so clear. Tat Tvam Asi. This is you. Or again, in such words as, I am in the east and in the west. I am below and above. I am this whole world. Letting A signify oneself and X ultimate reality, we might represent this manner of self-identification as follows. A does not equal X. As known phenomenologically, A is not X, yet in truth is indeed X. The oxymoron, self-contradictory, the paradox, the transcendent symbol pointing beyond itself is the gateless gate, the sun door, the passage beyond categories. Gods and Buddhas in the Orient are, accordingly, not final terms like Yahweh, the Trinity, or Allah in the West, but point beyond themselves to that ineffable being, consciousness and rapture that is the all in all of us. And in their worship, the ultimate aim is to effect in the devotee a psychological transfiguration through a shift of his plane of vision from the passing to the enduring, through which he may come finally to realize and experience, not simply as an article of faith, that he is identical with that before which he bows. These are, then, religions of identity. Their mythologies and associated rites, philosophies, sciences, and arts are addressed in the end not to the honor of any god out there, but to the recognition of divinity within. Returning to our text, the Great Forest Book, or Brihadaranyakopanishad, he has entered into all this, even to the fingernail tips, like a razor in the razor case, like fire in firewood. Him they see not, for as seen he is incomplete. When breathing he is named breath, when speaking voice, when seeing the eye, when hearing the ear, when thinking mind. These are just the names of his acts. Whoever worships one or another of these knows not, for he is incomplete in one or another of these. One should worship with the idea that he is just oneself, Atman, for therein all these become one. That same thing, namely this self, is the footprint of this all, for just as one finds cattle by a footprint, so one finds this all by its footprint, the self. Something similar appears to have been implied in the following quotations from the earliest religious writings known, the pyramid texts of the 5th and 6th dynasties of Old Kingdom Egypt, circa 2350 to 2175 BC, where the spirit of the deceased takes back into itself the manifold powers of the various gods that, during his lifetime, had been regarded as without. It is he, the deceased, who eats their magic and swallows their spirits. Their great ones are for his morning meal. Their middle-sized ones are for his evening meal. Their little ones are for his night meal. Their old men and old women are for his fire. Behold, their soul is in his belly. Their shadows are taken away from the hand of those to whom they belong. He is as that which dawns, which endures. And again, a millennium or so later, more explicitly from the Egyptian Book of the Dead, where the deceased himself is supposed to be speaking, my hair is the hair of Nu. My face is the face of the disk. My eyes are the eyes of Hathor, my ears are the ears of Apuat, my feet are the feet of Ptah. There is no member of my body that is not the member of some god. I am yesterday, today, and tomorrow, and I have the power to be born a second time. I am the divine hidden soul who creates the gods. Hail, Lord of the shrine that stands in the middle of the earth. He is I, and I am he, and Ta has covered his sky with crystal. Essentially the same, or at least a like idea, is suggested in certainly early Mesopotamian seals, some of which are of about the date of the pyramid texts. One such seal, Sumer circa 2500 BC, for instance, shows a devotee approaching the altar of the Lord of the Tree of Life, with his right hand lifted in worship, and on his left arm a goat, his offering. The gracious god in return proffers the cup of ambrosial drink, drawn from the fruit or sap of the tree, which bestows that gift of immortality which, centuries later, was to be denied to Adam and Eve. The god is horned, like the moon above his cup, for the moon is the sign celestial of the ever-enduring resurrection. As the lord of the tides of the womb, forever waxing and waning, it carries, like life, its own dead within it, yet also its victory over death. In another seal, the Garden of Immortality, Babylonia, circa 1750 to 1550 BC, we see its crescent again. However, the tree this time is attended by the dual apparition of a goddess known as Gulabau, whose later classical counterparts, Demeter and Persephone, were the goddesses without peer of both the Orphic and the Eleusinian mysteries. In this ancient Babylonian seal of circa 1750 to 1550 BC, approximately one millennium earlier than the Garden text of the Bible, the dual goddess of the plains of life and of death is passing the fruit of deathlessness to a mortal woman approaching from the left. Another figure from an early Sumerian seal, circa 2500 BC, shows the god and goddess together, lord and lady of the tree, in the company, however, of the serpent, not the moon. For as the moon sheds death in the figure of its shadow, so the serpent, its slough, to be born again of itself. These are equivalent symbols, heavenly and earthly, of the ever-dying, ever-living being of beings that is life in the garden of this world. In India, Shiva is the counterpart, worshipped to this hour, of the god at the foot of the tree, dispensing the moon elixir of life, and in the 6th century BC, when the prince Siddhartha, in his meditations, arrived at the foot of that same world tree, he there achieved the boon of illumination, which he then dispensed to the world, himself in the place and role of the god. Likewise, in the classical mystery cults, the aim of the quest of the initiate was to realize in himself divinity. Happy and blessed one, we read on a golden Orphic tablet of circa 300 BC, thou shalt be God instead of mortal. And Apuleius, 2nd century AD at the end of the ordeal of the golden ass, was, through the bounty of the goddess Isis, transformed into the likeness of a god. In my right hand I carried a lighted torch, and a garland of flowers was on my head, with white palm leaves sprouting out on every side like rays. Thus I was adorned like to the sun, and made in fashion of an image, when the curtains were drawn aside, and all the people crowded to behold me. Among the North European Celts and Germans also, the wonderful drink of deathlessness, Sanskrit, Amrita, Greek, Ambrosia, was known under many guises. Odin, Wotan, gave an eye for a sip from the Well of Wisdom at the foot of the world ash, Yggdrasil, where it was guarded by Mimir, the dwarf. And aloft in Valhall, his hero hall, the warrior dead drank of a mead served by the Valkyries that restored them to life and joy. Similarly, the Celtic sea god Mananan served in his dwelling under waves an ale that bestowed immortality on his guests. And for a taste of the sort of knowledge once gained from such ambrosial fare by initiates of the Celtic race, we have the famous charm of Emergan the Magician from the Irish Libor Gibuala, Book of Invasions. I am the wind that blows o'er the sea. I am the wave of the deep. I am the bull of seven battles. I am the eagle on the rock. I am a tear of the sun. I am the fairest of plants. I am a boar for courage. I am a salmon in the water. I am a lake on the plain. I am the word of knowledge. I am the head of the battle-dealing spear. I am the god who fashions thought in the mind. Religions of Relationship. But now, in irreconcilable contrast to this ancient, practically universal mode of experience of the world's and one's own dimension of divinity, which I have termed mythic identification, There is the order of beliefs derived from the biblical tradition, where Yahweh, as we know, arriving very late on the scene, cursed the serpent of the garden, and with it the whole earth, which he seems to have thought he had created. Here God creates the world, and the two are not the same. Creator and creature, ontologically distinct, are not to be identified with each other in any way. In fact, an experience of identity is the prime heresy of these systems and punishable by death. Their formula, therefore, is not, as in the earlier and more general order, A is not equal to equal to X, but A is related to X. A R X. And what is the medium of relationship? The local social group. For example, in the Hebrew context, God has ordained a covenant with a certain Semitic people. Birth as a member of that holy race and observance of its rituals of the covenant are the means of achieving a relationship with God. No other means are known or admitted to exist. Comparably in the Christian view, Christ, the only Son of God, is at once true God and true man. This, throughout the Christian world, is regarded as a miracle, whereas, in keeping with the earlier formula of A is not equal to X, we are all true God and true man. All things are Buddha things. Brahman sleeps in the stone. What is required is only that one should waken to that truth and thereafter live illuminated. Buddha, from the root bud, to know, to notice, to wake, to revive, to come to one's senses. According to the Christian view, no one except Christ can declare, I and the Father are one, John chapter 10 verse 30. Hence also, no one comes to the Father but by me, John chapter 14 verse 6. Through Christ's humanity, we are related to him. Through his godhood, he relates us to divinity. Thus, he and he alone is the pivot. Apart from him, we are apart from God, who, though just and merciful, is wrathful too, and was sorely offended by Adam's sin, the guilt of which we have all somehow inherited. God in Christ became man. Accepting death on the cross, he atoned mankind with the Father. No individual, however, can participate in that reconciliation but by membership in his church, which he founded on the Rock of Peter sometime around 30 AD. Mythologized, the cross of Christ was equated early in the Middle Ages with the tree of immortal life, the tree forbidden in the garden and Christ crucified with its fruit, his blood, the ambrosial drink. The sacrifice of the Mass, furthermore, was interpreted as a renewal of the sacrifice on Calvary, through which the Redeemer imparts to the faithful of his church the grace gained for them on the cross. In terms of the imagery of the closed garden gate with the cherubim and the turning sword, Christ, as a kind of Prometheus, has broken past the frightening guard and gained access for mankind to immortal life, as proclaimed in the hymn O Salutaris Hostia, sung at the benediction of the Blessed Sacrament. O Salutaris Hostia, quae celipandis ostium, O saving victim, who hast opened wide heaven's gates. However, in contrast to the Oriental, Buddhist, and Vedantic ways of interpreting the symbolism of the guarded gate and passage to the tree, as referring namely to an inward psychological barrier and crisis of transcendence, the authorized Christian reading has been of an actual, concrete, historic event of atonement with an angry God who for centuries had withheld his boon of paradise from mankind until strangely reconciled by this curious self-giving of his only son to a criminal's death on the cross. The fact of the crucifixion was read as the central fact of all history, and along with it certain other associated facts were accepted, such as in other mythological traditions would be interpreted psychologically, or, as theologians say, spiritually, as symbols, such as 1. The virgin birth, 2. The resurrection, 3. The ascension, 4. The existence of a heaven to which a physical body might ascend, and of course, 5. That fall in the Garden of Eden circa 4004 BC, from the guilt of which the crucifixion has redeemed us. God in this system is a kind of fact somewhere, an actual personality to whom prayers can be addressed with expectation of a result. He is apart from and different from the world, in no sense identical with it, but related as cause to effect. I call this kind of religious thinking mythic dissociation. The sense of an experience of the sacred is dissociated from life, from nature, from the world, and transferred or projected somewhere else, and imagined somewhere else, while man, mere man, is accursed. In the sweat of your face you shall eat bread till you return to the ground, for out of it you were taken. You are dust, and to dust you shall return. Genesis chapter 3, verse 19. The sacred is now not secular, of this world mere dead dust, but canonical, supernaturally revealed and authoritatively preserved. That is to say, God from out there has condescended graciously to accord special revelations, one, to the Hebrews, historically on Sinai via Moses, two, to mankind, historically in Bethlehem, via Jesus, but then also apparently, three, to mankind once again historically in a cave near Mecca via Muhammad. All, it will be noted, Semites. No other revelations of this desert god are admitted to exist, and extra ecclesiam nulla salus. To the formula of mythic dissociation, therefore, there must now be added that of social identification. Identification with Israel, with the Church as the living body of Christ, or with the Sunnah of Islam. Each body overinterpreted by its membership as the one and only holy thing in this world, and the focal center and source of all this holiness is concentrated in each case in a completely unique and special fetish, not a symbol but a fetish. One, the Ark of the Covenant in the temple, two, the Torah in the synagogue, three, the transubstantiated host of the Roman Catholic Church, four, the Bible of the Reformation, five, the Quran, as well as six, the Kaaba of Islam. In India and the Far East, such revered supports of the religious life would be known, finally, to point beyond themselves and their anthropomorphic God, beyond names, forms, and all scriptural personification, to that immanent transcendent mystery of being which defies thought, feeling, and figuration. For whereas the attitude of focused piety is there recognized as appropriate for those not yet able to live in the realization of their own identity with that, tat tvam asi, for anyone ready for an actual religious experience of his own, such canonized props are impediments. Where is self-knowledge for him whose knowledge depends on the object, we read in a Vedantic text. The wise do not see a this and a that, but the self, Atman, immutable. You have your own treasure house, said the 8th century Chinese sage Ma Zi. Why do you search outside? However, as another sage, Wei Quan, once declared to a monk in quest of enlightenment, as long as there is I and thou, this complicates the situation, and there is no seeing Tao. When there is neither I nor thou, is it seen? The monk then asked. When there is neither I nor thou, came the paradoxical answer, who is here to see it? That is, A does not equal equals X. Or, to quote again Ramakrishna, the essence of Vedanta is Brahman alone is real, and the world is illusory. I have no separate existence. I am that Brahman alone. But for those who lead a worldly life, and for those who identify themselves with the body, this attitude of I am he is not good. It is not good for householders to read the Vedanta. It is very harmful for them to read these books. Householders should look on God as master and on themselves as his servants. They should think, O God, you are the master and the Lord, and I am your servant. People who identify themselves with the body should not have the attitude of, I am he. The point is simply that the meditation, not this, neti, neti, must be accomplished before I am Brahman, Brahmasmi, and it is here, iti, iti. However, when the latter is begun, the fetish, the idol, is left behind, as it was when Ramakrishna flung his flowers all about. And there is a parallel here, too, to Socrates' doctrine of beauty in the Symposium, when he states, quoting the wise woman Diotima, that when the lover has learned to appreciate the beauty of one individual body, he must consider how nearly related the body of any one body is to the beauty of any other.